الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا محمد وعلى آله وأصحابه وأئمته وبارك وسلم. وقد قال الله سبحانه وتعالى: فأعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، إن الحكم إلا لله. Last week we concluded with a quick overview of the nomination of Sayyidina Umar bin Khattab. And in the case of the second Khalif, Umar bin Khattab, we mentioned that the very same principle was there. Even though the methodology varied somewhat with the needs of the time, we described how when the first Khalif, Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu, was on his deathbed, people approached him, those in political authority, gave him authorization to suggest and nominate one person to succeed him, just to minimize the potential for dispute. So they relinquished their right of nomination to the Khalif Abu Bakr. And this is testament to the integrity and the prestige that Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu enjoyed amongst his peers. We mentioned in Islam that rulership is a meritocracy. It's about the inherent merit, the capacity of individuals to rule. And as a consequence, in those enjoying the prerogative of nomination of a ruler, relinquishing that right to someone like Abu Bakr is a testament to the integrity and the excellence of Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu as a ruler, a man who served his people well and captured their hearts. But nevertheless, what happened is that Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu, we find, as we described last week, consulted with the prominent companions and nominated amongst them, from amongst those prominent companions, Umar bin Khattab as the second Khalif. Now, Umar's legitimacy was established again only after he went to the masjid, just as his predecessor Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu did, and just as the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam himself did when he came to the bay'ah, the pledge of allegiance from the Ansar. People came and pledged their allegiance to Umar and accepted him. So the same principle was implemented in the case of the third, at least in the case of the second Khalif, that of nomination, and thereafter that nomination be affirmed by the public pledge of allegiance or the bay'ah. Today we'll quickly go through the system of nomination of the third and the fourth Khalif. As a quick revision, Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu was chosen through what we could call a general plebiscite. In other words, a general election. Where amongst the many potential successors to the Prophet, he was elected by the overwhelming majority, the overwhelming consensus of the people of the time. Umar radiallahu anhu essentially was nominated by one individual, by Abu Bakr, and thereafter his nomination was affirmed through the general pledge of allegiance again of the masses. The third mechanism whereby an individual can assume rulership or khilafah in Islam occurs with the election of Sayyidina Uthman bin Affan. What happened, without going into the details of the assassination of Sayyidina Umar bin Khattab, but while Sayyidina Umar bin Khattab was dying, he gave suggestions in order to avoid again conflict or division within the Muslim community. And amongst the suggestions he made was identifying six prominent companions of the Prophet who acknowledged as the de facto rulers and authorities within the Islamic world of their time. And they were also from amongst what are popularly called the Ashara Mubashara, those 10 companions of the Prophet ﷺ who received explicit glad tidings in this world that they would enter paradise on the tongue of the Prophet himself ﷺ. And this is a consequence of Allah being pleased with them, the Prophet no doubt being pleased with them, because of their faith, their fidelity, their commitment, their profound sacrifice for Islam. Again, their merit and their service to the faith and to the people qualifies them for nomination to rule. Now, these six were included amongst others with the nomination of Umar bin Khattab, who on his deathbed essentially elects what we could call today an electoral council. So the first one was a general plebiscite, Abu Bakr. The second one was a nomination by the ruler that currently lives. The third is an electoral council. And within that electoral council, Umar chose Ali bin Abi Talib, Uthman bin Affan, Abdurrahman bin Auf, Sa'ad bin Mu'adh, Zubair and Talha. Now, anyone who knows anything about Islamic history will understand the importance and the prominence of these six giants in Islamic, early Islamic history. Umar obviously was very strict, and he emphasized that these six should meet together and they should nominate one person from among themselves to be suggested to the people, and that there should be no division and none of them should deviate from this nomination. So from amongst the six, choose one. We find a very similar system within, and like I said, there's some similarity with the American system of election of a head of state, some serious flaws, but having said that, even in the United States, till today we have an electoral council. A person like George Bush, for example, who came to rule the United States and the so-called free world, did so under very dubious circumstances through this very same mechanism of an electoral council in the United States. But nevertheless, Islam sets a precedent 1400 years ago, and once Umar radiallahu anhu elected these six to sit in the council, he emphasized how as soon as agreement is reached, that each and every one of them should unite to support that particular choice. There should be no dissension, and if there is, there should be very strict and severe consequences for those who deviate from the consensus of that council. It's ultimately the well-being of an entire empire, and I hate using this word empire, but I can think of nothing less. The entire Khilafah was at stake. During the meeting of the six, Abdurrahman bin Auf made a suggestion. He said, who among you offers to withdraw his nomination? He said, to then minimize the potential candidates. There was some silence, and then he himself took the initiative and said that he withdraws his nomination and he has no desire to be a ruler whatsoever, but upon withdrawing his nomination, that he would then be a mediator in deciding who the nominated ruler should be from amongst the five remaining candidates. He then took an oath from the five that whatever is decided by him, everyone would follow. So in this way we find again the very important principle of omission of vested interests be implemented in the mechanism of choice of a ruler. Unfortunately, if you look at modern democracies, vested interests ultimately come to prevail over the choice of a ruler. And more often than not, they're corporate interests. They are financial interests at play. If you look at the United States, without billions of dollars, unfortunately now, coming from the private sector, it's impossible for you to be nominated to be president of the United States. They have vested, selfish, corporate interests, unfortunately, that are at play quite significantly in the choice of so-called democratic rulers. Now, Islam omits that, and this is one mechanism whereby those who seem to have the greatest vested interest withdraw so as to negate the possibility of vested interest playing a part. And we find with Abdurrahman bin Auf, this becomes a principle that's quite preeminently emphasized. In any event, Abdurrahman then adopts a number of approaches to ascertain what the consensus of the people are. And by the people, there are two types. One is obviously those, again, who have political authority, who have the capacity to effect political outcomes, and also the laity, the general masses. So he approaches the people, and specifically approaches the two more prominent members of this committee of five, Ali and Uthman. He goes to each of them individually in private, and firstly to Uthman, he says, suppose you were not the one to be chosen to be a ruler, who do you think would be the most deserving? Upon which Sayyidina Uthman radiallahu anhu said, Ali bin Abi Talib. Thereupon Sayyidina Abdurrahman bin Auf goes to Sayyidina Ali and asks him the very same question, that if you were not chosen as ruler, who do you think is the most fitting to assume this awesome responsibility? Upon which Sayyidina Ali radiallahu anhu says, Uthman. In addition to this, Sayyidina Abdurrahman bin Auf also goes to the two other prominent members, Az-Zubair and Sa'ad, and asks the very same question, upon which both of them seem to indicate their strong preference for Uthman. So again we find the consensus of this electoral council is tending towards Sayyidina Uthman bin Affan. And this was the way of getting a feeling of what the preference of the committee members were, this electoral council was. In addition, Abdurrahman bin Auf then spends several days and nights meeting and discussing and consulting with the Sahaba of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, in addition with consulting with the common people. Now the Sahaba play a very important role in the early expansion of Islam militarily, but also in the governance of the various Islamic provinces. Now remember, upon the death of Sayyidina Umar bin Khattab, Islam had already reached the Byzantine Roman Empire and taken large swaths of that empire. Islam had conclusively conquered the Persian Empire and reached now into the Indus, and Islam had marched across North Africa. So there were multiple provinces, and the Sahaba, the companions of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, assumed very prominent roles as governors. And it's Sayyidina Abdurrahman bin Auf that spends many nights meeting with these people from the far-flung provinces, and also those scholars, the fuqaha, mujtahideen amongst the Sahaba radiallahu anhum ajmain, as well as the general laity, the masses of the people. And what he finds is that both Ali and Uthman radiallahu anhu seem to be the most acceptable and the strongest candidates, with a slight edge for Uthman. And we already can see in this what happens in modern democratic elections. We find a continuous update as to the votes, the preference of the people. And this is what Sayyidina Abdurrahman bin Auf is able to very effectively do. One of the reasons why is because in Islam we have a thing called the Hajj and the Umrah. So there's a constant movement of people from the far-flung provinces of the Islamic world to the center, the heart of Islam, not just the spiritual heart, but also the administrative heart of Islam, Medina Munawwar. In addition to this, Sayyidina Abdurrahman bin Auf holds a general meeting in Masjid al-Nabawi, which is the central masjid, not just of Medina, but in fact of the Khilafah. People obviously are regularly congregating, coming for Umrah or for Ziyarah of the Maqbara, the grave of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And by the way, it's another thing. We talk about visiting graves of the righteous, because this is another bid'ah in Islam whereby it has been negated as being an innovation. They are within the Wahhabi inclined sects in Islam, those who seem to suggest that visiting a grave is complete innovation. That's not true. In fact, there are many hadith throughout the hadith literature that emphasizes the importance of visiting the graves of Anbiya and the righteous. But having said that, we'll come back to that later. Many of the Sahaba and many of the Muslims at that time would specifically come to Medina just for ziyarah of the Maqbara, the grave of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. We'll go into that subject some other time. In any event, it's very important because it allows the mechanism for free flow of information and contact between Muslims from the far-flung provinces of the Islamic Khilafah and obviously the central administration. And what Sayyidina Abdurrahman bin Auf discovers, meeting with the Muhajireen, meeting with the Ansar, the people of Medina, the leaders of the armies, the generals, those coming on business trips, the heads of finance and of the mercantile world of Islam of that day, and also public discussions, he finds that people are inclined tremendously towards Uthman and obviously Sayyidina Ali bin Abi Talib. And the verses of Sayyidina Ali and Sayyidina Uthman bin Affan eventually lead Sayyidina Abdurrahman bin Auf to the conclusion that these are the two most acceptable candidates amongst the many to the masses. And of the two, Uthman bin Affan seems to be the preferred candidate. Sayyidina Abdul Rahman bin Auf then makes his choice, and when he offered that they should pledge the allegiance to Uthman, what was the outcome? People accepted it. But the reason simply was that this was the candidate that was most acceptable to the people. So acceptance comes with acceptability. Not only was he a person who distinguishes himself in his piety and virtue, but also in his capacity, in his the skill set that allows him to administer civil matters. But this is not enough. It's only when this nomination is accepted by the masses and the general laity of people, then affirming through the bay'ah, through the public pledge of allegiance, that Sayyidina Uthman bin Affan then gains legitimacy as a third successor of the rule of the Prophet of Islam after the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So we find here a very quick, brief overview. I'd strongly encourage you to read some books regarding it. It's a fascinating field of study. But what we do find is that this represents the third mechanism of nomination of a ruler. The first is the general election. The second is the nomination by the current ruler. The third is an electoral council. Now, why these mechanisms change slightly is because circumstances in the Islamic world are changing quite rapidly. And Islam is the only system of law that has these multiple mechanisms of nomination of a ruler. Till today, even modern Western democracies don't have that degree of flexibility. Now what happens, and we'll very quickly introduce Sayyidina Ali bin Abi Talib's nomination. The reign of Sayyidina Uthman radiallahu anhu was supremely successful. And Islam spread exponentially across the world at the same rate that it spread during the time of Sayyidina Umar bin Khattab. However, towards the end of the Khilafah of Sayyidina Uthman, civil strife began to emerge, and unfortunately, without going into the details, the civil strife was orchestrated by subversive elements within the Muslim community who, taking full advantage of the large numbers of newly converted nations, began then to manipulate matters in such a way that eventually led to the assassination of Sayyidina Uthman bin Affan, the third Khalif. Now, we won't go into the details, but there's a telling lesson for us as Muslims from the very early days of the dangers of the enemy within. The fifth column, the subversives, the conspirators. Like, for example, our so-called Arab Spring. A masterfully orchestrated subversion of the Islamic world, or the Muslim world. The target being not the rulers of the Muslim world, but the civilian population. And, obviously, the stability and infrastructure of those respective nations. But having said that, this is not the time and the place to go into the events that lead to the assassination of Sayyidina Uthman bin Affan. But what can be conclusively said is that there were subversive elements that orchestrate this, ultimately leading to the assassination of Uthman bin Affan. Now, Uthman bin Affan obviously was renowned for his piety, for his scrupulousness. Following his assassination, the situation was no doubt chaotic. It was perplexing. This was the first time in Islamic history we find that an Islamic ruler is killed by a rebellious element from within the Islamic community itself. Quite a new situation, a novel situation. At this point, Sayyidina Ali radiallahu anhu was Wazir al-A'la. He was the chief vizier, the primary, or what you could call the prime minister. Amongst all the ministers, the Wazir al-A'la, the prime minister of Sayyidina Uthman bin Affan. Sayyidina Ali obviously was distressed, he was despondent about what had happened to Sayyidina Uthman bin Affan. And as a consequence, he isolates himself. He goes away into seclusion. Some of the prominent Sahaba of the Prophet then approach him. And like I said, this is a very quick summary. They beg him and say that in this time and in this situation, they cannot think of anyone who is more qualified and competent to be the fourth Khalif. Because essentially, Sayyidina Ali bin Abi Talib was the right-hand man of Sayyidina Uthman bin Affan. If anyone knew the mechanisms of administration of this vast empire, which was now the largest empire on earth, it would be no one else but Ali bin Abi Talib. Now, Sayyidina Ali radiallahu anhu was actually reluctant to accept, and he preferred rather to be a wazir, an advisor, a vizier, and not a ruler. And this is very telling, because it somehow makes it very clear, even to our Shiite brethren, that Sayyidina Ali was not covetous for rule. And this was the character of all the Khalifs. They were not people who desired rule. They were not people who were pandering for power. They were humble, and they assumed the office of Khilafah not because they desired, but because they were compelled. And this is the distinctive feature of the first four Khalifs. It was because of duress from the electorate, the masses. They assumed the responsibility, and they understand that this position requires a great deal of sacrifice, obviously unlike today, where rulers have all sorts of benefits, to the point that a head of state can't be prosecuted for crimes, essentially, or else people like John Howard would be sitting in the docks right now because of the egregious human rights violations with the Iraq war, at the very least. So in Islam, there's no such amnesty for rulers. But having said that, Sayyidina Ali bin Abi Talib's response was quite telling. Firstly, he's reluctant. He doesn't want to assume this position. He says, let me rather just be an advisor, a supporter. And once he's pressed under duress by the prominent Sahaba of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and they say, incidentally, these prominent Sahaba are what, and I hate using this description, Sunni Shia. We've already discussed Shiaism and the emergence of Shiaism, but it was the Sunni so-called leaders and power brokers that imposed, for want of better words, Khilafah upon Sayyidina Ali bin Abi Talib. If there was ever a conflict between so-called Sunni Shia, this was the point at which we'd find the whole narrative being most perplexing. Why would Sunnis want to raise a Shiite imam to the position of leadership? Anyway, so that debunks that whole theory of the Shiite brethren amongst us regarding the apparent conflict between Sunni Shia. There's no such a thing. At least, not from the perspective of mainstream Islam. So Sayyidina Ali radiallahu anhu says something very telling. He says, I cannot accept this unless it happens in Masjid al-Nabawi, which was obviously the common place for meeting for all Muslims and the opportunity for any Muslim, irrespective, to express his or her views. And then Sayyidina Ali says, there must be acceptance and consent of the masses. Now this again emphasizes the basic principle, which was adhered to by all the previous Khalifs, Abu Bakr, Umar, and Uthman radiallahu ta'ala anhum ajma'in. It shows that regardless of the specific method or mechanism, and this is what we can call an emergency measure, and we find this, for example, in the assassination of Kennedy. Immediately Lyndon Johnson assumes the presidency as an emergency mechanism. The second in charge, the vice president, or the prime minister in this particular case, assumes rulership. So it shows that regardless of the specific method or mechanism, as far as these four rightly, that's why we call them Khulafa' al-Rashidin, the rightly guided Khalifs are concerned, each was nominated, the mechanisms changed, no doubt, because of differing circumstances. In the case of Sayyidina Ali bin Abi Talib, it was an emergency circumstance. They didn't have the opportunity of going through any electoral process. But what is very important is that it is only legitimized through the public bay'ah, the public pledge of allegiance, where there is public acceptance of that particular nomination. Now we'll stop here. We've got three more to go, and the next three we'll do very briefly. That of Sayyidina Hassan bin Abi Talib, bin Ali bin Abi Talib, Sayyidina Hassan, who becomes the next Khalif, the fifth, and Sayyidina Muawiyah bin Affan, who becomes the sixth, and then Yazid bin Muawiyah, radiallahu ta'ala anhum ajma'in. These three. And they will then essentially exhaust the first seven mechanism of nomination of a Khalif in Islam. وآخر دعوانا أن الحمد لله رب العالمين